Jeff Palermo is in studio as we wait for Mr. Bakay. Jeff is the news director for the Louisiana Radio Network. And what's your take on the most accessible governor you've covered?
You're saying John Bel Edwards is the most...
No, I'm saying, is he or is it somebody else?
That's a good question. Well, it's not Bobby Jindal, that's for sure. Especially after, Bobby Jindal was accessible during the first term, but not so much in the second term as he was really starting to mount his run for president. Mike Foster just didn't really like talking to the media all that much, so I wouldn't put him up there. But I would say it's close between Governor Edwards and Governor John Bel Edwards. I wasn't around to cover Governor Edwin Edwards and Kathleen Blanco. But I'll say in his first 4 years, Governor Jindal was very accessible to the media.
Well, it changed, and it didn't work for him because he tried to become president of the United States, and despite his efforts to concentrate on national media, he left the campaign, as we know, with zero delegates. But Dean Bakay on the line, the executive editor of the New York Times, and good morning to you from Manhattan, Dean Bakay. It's nice to hear your voice.
It's one moment, and I'll put Dean on.
All right. That didn't sound like Dean Bakay. That sounded like his assistant, June. So Dean is obviously a busy man. So,
hi, it's Dean Bakay. I'm so sorry. I was late.
That's quite all right. We've got you now, and that's all that counts.
Great.
Well we wanted to, before we talk about your event with WRKF, Dean, certainly mm-hmm. this is an interesting time for media. And as I look at your newspaper today, there is a story about the president's veracity. And the word lie is used again. And this is something that in the old days was taboo. But the headline today says many politicians lie, but Trump has elevated the art of fabrication. What do you make of the environment we're in right now?
That's a good question. I mean, we actually have used the word lie very infrequently, except sometimes I think it's just called for. I mean, sometimes you can't sort of use newspaper language to conceal and the fact that the president, and we've said this a lot, does have a tendency to exaggerate. And in a couple of instances, I don't think anybody would disagree that he's actually made stuff up. I think part of it is his shtick as a salesman. Anybody who's read about the life of Donald Trump knows that he takes pleasure in, he's a guy who sells stuff. He tells you his buildings will be taller, bigger, more expensive, fancier, and finished on time, even though in many instances he knows that not to be the case. And I think what we're finding is he's carried that same style into the White House, and I think we have to call him on it when it's very clear that something is false.
Well, he has been certainly aggressive in his assessment of the media, and in particular your organization. But before we get there, he at the same time has provided at times remarkable access.
Yeah, I think that I think two things. First off, he actually likes the media. Again, Donald Trump, the salesman, somebody who learned a lot from Roy Cohn, which he would admit himself, would say that he, in fact, believes that you prefer good press, but a lot of press is also worth a lot to you. And I think the New York Times, he has sort of an odd relationship with us. On the one hand, we've been very aggressive in covering him, as we all are with all presidents. But he's also a hometown boy. He can't help himself but talk to the New York Times. It's his paper.
Yeah. And he had a meeting with you before he took the oath of office. Shortly after he was elected, he came to your headquarters. How was that experience?
It was interesting. He had called a bunch of media executives together a few days before, and we didn't participate in that. I didn't think that an off-the-record session with the President of the United States with other media executives to be scolded was a position the New York Times wanted to be in. But when he came here and met with us, he placed his audience. It was, and the editorial board was there. And while I and the newsroom make very clear not to discuss our political views, the New York Times editorial board leaned left. And he spoke to to the people on the editorial board. He said the things they wanted to hear. If you were to take snippets of that conversation, if you were to read the transcript, it's of a moderate, maybe even moderate Republican, moderate Democrat. I think he just sort of played to the crowd. Look, he is a charming guy. He is very good at sort of selling himself. It was interesting. It was an interesting anthropological experience, I have to say.
One of your editorialists, and a very good one, and a Louisianian, Charles Blow, wrote that he declined to attend this event with Mr. Trump. What did you make of that?
You know, Charles is in a completely different position. And Charles is a friend, and he's from Louisiana, like me. The editorial board can say pretty much whatever they want, and they can take positions that I would never take. Charles has set himself up, and I think that's, you know, within the bounds of a good columnist, to be a constant critic and even opponent of the administration. I'm in a little bit of a different position because the newsroom of the New York Times does not want to be the leader of the opposition party to Donald Trump. Our job is to cover him aggressively, ask hard questions, and in fact, if people thought of us as and some people do, unfortunately, and they're wrong, if people thought of us as the opposition to Trump, they wouldn't take seriously some of the stories we write. I mean, I think people believe us and our stories have impact because we're aggressive, but we're straight. Charles can take a completely different stance, and he does it, you know, in a really interesting way.
Has President Trump been good for business?
Yes, he has, because news is good for business. And, you know, we usually hit, I mean, you can relate to this, we usually hit these long periods of slumps, but this is a guy who keeps making news. He's endlessly interesting. And to be honest, his attacks on us have inspired people to stand up for the newspaper. Whenever he attacks us, more people subscribe, because I think people see us, rightly, I hope, as an important journalistic institution at a time when so many institutions are being called into question. So, he's been great for business.
But at the same time, Dean, he calls you the failing New York Times, and every time he says that, you're saying you get more subscribers.
Yes, we do. Now, some of that is because I think we do a good job. Most of that is because we do a good job. But I think people look at that and they say, you know, look, we don't want any president to be able to belittle or hurt journalistic institutions. And we want to make sure to send a signal to the world that we want the Times to survive.
I know you still come this way on occasion, and you also worked at the Times-Picayune for a while, Dean.
I did. I started at the State Item to show how old I am, and then went to work for the Times-Picayune.
Well, growing up in New Orleans, in the 70s and 80s, and 90s, I guess, early 90s, that was a time when the city was adjusting, as it continues to do, but there's no place like New Orleans.
Right. No, that's right. I've lived at a lot of different places since I graduated from high school, but New Orleans remains home, and my whole family's there, so I come back often.
Well, you studied English at Columbia University. Must have been a heady moment to go from New Orleans to New York when you graduated from St. Aug.
It was. In fact, it was the first time I'd ever left Louisiana, was to hop on an airplane to go to New York for my freshman year at Columbia. And I spent most of my time with other friends from New Orleans, to give you an idea how shy a Southern boy I was in New York City.
And then there were a number of New Orleanians at Columbia at that time?
Oh, there were tons. There were tons. One of my college roommates is a guy named Eric Granderson, who worked in city government for a while. There's a guy named Kenneth Kanye, who's a local doctor in Louisiana. We spent all of our time waiting for shipments of food from New Orleans.
And I noted that you, of course, have what arguably is the top role in journalism as the executive editor of the New York Times. Not far away at the Wall Street Journal, a New Orleanian, Alex Martin, is the news editor for the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah, Alex was one of the best young reporters at the Times-Picayune when I was there. He covered St. Bernard Parish. The bureau chief was Jim Amos, who later became editor of the Times-Picayune. And Alex is now one of the senior-most editors at the Wall Street Journal. But there are a lot of us up here. Walter Isaacson, he used to run Time Magazine, has been up here, though he moved back to New Orleans. Nick Lemon, who was the head of Columbia's journalism school. Chris Drew, who was a reporter here, who just retired to be a professor of journalism at LSU. So there was quite a Jason DeParle, who covered justice in New Orleans and now writes books and works for the New York Times. There are quite a few of us up here.
Now, you have worked in journalism, Dean, in New York, New Orleans, Chicago, Los Angeles, some of the great spots to be a reporter, but how do those cities differ in covering the news, if at all?
They differ a lot. The most intensely competitive city I've ever worked in, two cities actually, but the most intensely competitive for local news was Chicago. Chicago had two very powerful newspapers when I was a reporter for the Tribune, really powerful local television stations. This is in the, I guess, the late 80s. And then I was the Washington bureau chief for the New York Times. And there's nothing more competitive than Washington. It's just a hugely, at that time, every great news organization in the country had a presence in Washington. New Orleans, which I like, has a good newspaper war going between Baton Rouge, between the Advocate and the Picayune. And I think that's great. I think that's healthy for journalism, because the thing I fear the most, not to ramble on, is the decline in local news coverage. So to see a place that can support two local newspapers fighting it out, not to mention radio and television, I think it's terrific and healthy for the democracy.
What about the state of journalism right now? The New York Times, like every other organization, is facing curtailment of staff, budget issues.
Yeah.
Is that affecting the quality of journalism?
You know, I'm not worried about people like the New York Times. I mean, I'm cutting mainly so that I can rehire and change the staff. We're roughly the same size we've always been, which is 12 to 1300. I am deeply worried about local journalism. The New York Times, the Journal, the Washington Post, the big networks, they'll be fine. You know, they'll have rough times, but you can sort of see the light at the end of the tunnel. We have access to so many readers that we can keep growing. I worry about New Orleans, Birmingham, Atlanta, Houston, Dallas, Fresno, because the business model for local news has essentially declined substantially. And I think it's going to be really important to figure out how to keep those institutions alive, because that's just so important to the democracy, that people know what the mayors and governors are doing. And that's under threat now like never before.
Okay, I've got a few questions from listeners. One asks about the press conference on Friday with the Attorney General Jefferson Sessions, who said he was going after leakers. Is that something that is prudent?
That's troublesome. I mean, people act like people think that leaks are just sort of unimportant and ways to drive subscriptions. The truth is, the greatest stories of every generation, whether it's Watergate or the biggest national security stories of the age, we would not know that the United States was engaged in a drone war on the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan if it was not for people who were willing to talk about that without their names used, because the government has never acknowledged it. The leaks are not just people manipulating reporters. Of course, there's some of that. But a lot of it is people who think that there are things people should know, and they can't attach their names to it because they could go to jail. This stuff is important. It would be awful for the democracy if people were prosecuted for talking to reporters.
Question about the technology. Do you see the news evolving, newspapers in particular, from traditional print to digital distribution? It's happening in some places, including New Orleans, but what about the nation as a whole?
It's inevitable. I mean, it's just inevitable. I mean, most of our readers now get the news on their phones. I think it's inevitable. And by the way, I think it's good. I know that's uncomfortable for people even of my generation to hear. I love print. But I now have a video unit. I would not have had a video unit in the era of print. I can now show things and illustrate things in such a powerful way. And as a kid growing up in New Orleans, I had access to only two newspapers, the Stateside and the Times-Picayune. That same kid growing up in New Orleans could read almost any news organization in the world. So as hard as this is, and as much as it makes people nervous, it's better.
Mm-hmm. You think we'll always have a print edition of the New York Times?
I think for a long, 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 long time. There's been no evidence that there's no evidence that it's eroding. So I think for a long time. I would never say forever, because if you'd asked me 10 years ago that more people would read us on this little telephone than anything else, I would have tried to have you committed.
Mm-hmm.
So who knows? But right now there's great interest and desire for print, including by me.
Me too. Another question, how should we feel about anonymous sources?
I think news organizations, including my own, sometimes overuse them. But that said, we have a story on the front page this morning about a dramatic finding by a group of climate scientists working for the government. It came from anonymous sources. We would not have been able to tell that to people without anonymous sources. We also had a story on the front page about the turmoil within the CIA over its new director. Again, that came from anonymous sources. But I think if you look at those two stories, I hope you'll agree with me, it's worth it.
And Dean, I know you take great pride in coming back home and telling your story and the story of American journalism, and there's much to discuss in these times.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I agree. It's a heady time and an important time. It's a historic moment for American journalism, I think.
A question from another listener who asked, do you think a representative democracy can endure if lying by public officials becomes standard operating procedure?
I'm a believer in that the country's democracy is pretty resilient. I think that over time, I think that over time, people are good at sorting out fact from fiction, and I think the most important role of journalism is to help them do it. I'm pretty confident that our democracy in particular is strong enough and resilient enough to withstand most anything. I do.
Halen, let's take one call, and we'll let Dean get on his way, but we have a few folks have been waiting, and let's go to Connie and Baker. Connie, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana with Dean Baquet.
How are you?
Thank you for taking my call. I'm fine. Hope you are, too. I'm from New Orleans, and I'm wondering if Mr. Baquet's family was ever in the restaurant business.
That's my family. Yes. My father owned a restaurant called Eddie's, and I grew up
yes.
in the back of it. And my brother runs a restaurant called Little Dizzy's. So my family has always been in the restaurant business.
Okay, thank you so much.
And I don't cook very well.
But that was a big part of your formative years.
Yeah. Oh, completely. No, I spend my mornings helping to clean the restaurant. It's a big part of my life and history.
Well, anybody who's ever worked in a restaurant learns about humility pretty quickly, but you also you also learn about human nature.
Yeah, that's right. And you also it helps put New Orleans and its culture in your bones in a way that maybe nothing else does.
Well, we're glad you're coming back this way, and certainly pleased that a local man is doing well in the biggest arena in the world for journalism, the New York Times. Thank you, Dean Baquet.
Thank you. Take care and see you all soon.
That's
be well.
Deal. September 22nd, and you can find out more about the Founders Day Luncheon by going to WRKF.org. Dean Baquet, as you can hear, quite an eloquent and passionate man about what he does, will be the featured speaker at the Crown Plaza in Baton Rouge.